we made a turn around one of the switchbacks and this huge explosion went off, and it was, you know, obviously it was a bomb.
Yeah.
We didn't call it an IED back then. It was just a straight up bomb.
Right.
So lots of smoke, dust, debris, couldn't see too much. And I instantly remember going back to what we were trained to do, yeah. you and I as agents yeah. and how we do motorcades. And it was getting out of that attack site.
Welcome to After Action. I'm Chad Hammer. Today with us is the director of DSS, Carlos Matus. Director Matus has been an agent for 36 years and director for 3. Director Matus, thank you so much for joining us today.
That's good to see you, Chad. Thanks. Right. Thanks for having me.
Today we're going to talk about two big elements of your life as an agent. We've talked a little bit about how serving on the secretary's detail has been a bit of a rite of passage for most agents. You are no exception to that. Why don't you talk to us a little bit about the first time you served on the secretary's detail?
So that's a long time ago, yeah. right at the beginning of my career. I spent a considerable amount of time with Secretary Shultz and his family. Some of the historic moments that this country has gone through
yeah.
were with him.
Yeah.
And so I spent a better part of over 6, 7, 8 months with the secretary
okay.
as he traveled throughout Europe and Russia, Moscow, Soviet Union back then,
yeah.
and other places.
There was a significant incident that happened while you were touring through Latin America, I believe, right?
Yeah, 1988, August 8th, 1988. The context of back then was, you know, the flow of narcotics, mm-hmm. Precursors, Bolivia, mm-hmm. Colombia, Peru, and how all of that was making its way into the United States. And
Yeah, war on drugs at its peak, for sure.
So this was a trip to La Paz, Bolivia, and to Quito, Ecuador.
Okay.
We landed at El Alto Airport, got off the plane, assumed the positions in the motorcade.
Yeah. Probably 6 or 8 cars, 10 cars with local police.
Local police, probably 10 cars. They were armored at the time, and armoring back then meant a production vehicle off the line. And then we would add the armor afterwards, really like a Mad Max movie almost. So we were really constrained on how fast we could go. We made a turn around one of the switchbacks, and this huge explosion went off, and it was a bomb.
Yeah.
We didn't call it an IED back then. It was just a straight up bomb.
Right.
So lots of smoke, dust, debris, couldn't see too much. And I instantly remember going back to what we were trained to do,
yeah.
you and I as agents yeah. and how we do motorcades. And it was getting out of that attack site.
So there were some casualties, right?
Very light minor injuries.
Good.
I think the armor saved a lot or mitigated a lot of it.
Yeah.
I remember vividly to this day, I remember looking in the rearview mirror as we got out of there and I saw the spare limo spinning.
Wow.
The spare limo took the brunt of the force in the back, and Mrs. Shultz was in the spare limo.
Oh, man.
The secretary was furious.
Yeah.
I mean, who wouldn't be? He was furious, and he was no wallflowers. You know, he's a combat Marine.
Mm-hmm.
He made it very clear to everybody that we were going to continue with our schedule.
Wow.
We were going to be defiant, and we were not going to be deterred. And we did. And we maintained that schedule pretty aggressive, and he was on fire, as they say.
Yeah, so somebody had been watching. When you say command detonated, not on a timer. Like somebody had been watching and pulled the trigger.
The investigation revealed wiring about 50 to 60 feet away from the blast site.
Oh, pretty close, actually.
Pretty close.
Yeah.
Behind a telephone pole. Whoever the trigger guy was missed us. You know, the timing was off. So there was a little bit of luck there, like there always is.
And we don't try to make it super evident who's in what car, right, too. So.
No. Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, so, I mean, they could have gotten, I think, a direct hit on the limousine had they probably done it a couple seconds earlier.
So that was effectively what you later determined was maybe the cause behind the attack. Was that an attempt to intimidate or?
There was a combination of the counter-narcotics message we were sending, and there was this, a fledgling indigenous terrorist group developing the Bolivian version of ELN and the EGTK. The EGTK eventually took responsibility for the attack, which is a command detonated explosion. And that was a try to intimidate the U.S. government, I think.
So an interesting part about this story also is, you know, nowadays, if an agent is involved in an incident, they can text their family on whatever app they use to tell them immediately, hey, you're going to see something in the news, or you're going to hear about something, and I'm all right. But back in 88, it was not the case, right?
You know, when we do our jobs, and you know this, we are so focused on getting the mission accomplished that we tend to forget about letting people know that we're doing okay, which is one of my big themes right now as the director is taking care of ourselves and taking care of our people and our families. And it's really one of our cornerstones of good leadership and our tenets. And so I didn't think about it. and continued on with my day and protected him and drove him throughout the city of La Paz. I believe the GSO warehouse also sustained a grenade attack later that day as part of this intimidation.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until we got to the airport to leave that I started thinking about, well, I wonder if anybody knows what happened. And I later found out that my parents watching the 11 o'clock news, and that's how they found out that I had been involved in an attack in the South. So, and then the phone calls, you know, started. My mother yelled at me because I had 3 sticks of Bubblicious in my mouth and I was chewing out of control. I think more out of just anxiety and nerves.
Adrenaline pumping for sure.
But yeah, it's classic. It's classic what not to do.
Well, speaking of families, when you work in close protection, you get to know the families of the protectees in some cases, right?
Oh, yeah.
So you got close with the Schultz family. You spent a lot of time with them, right?
Right. Spent a lot of time with them, 24-7 protection detail. The current detail members on Secretary Blinken know this well. And yeah, we become part of their families. I distinctively and warmly remember Mrs. Schultz baking cookies for us.
Yeah.
And she would bring them downstairs into the basement. Where we had our CP, you know, with drinks and are you guys okay?
Yeah.
Can I get you anything?
Because the secretary doesn't have a dedicated residence. So they were effectively at what was already their home.
We were in their home,
Yeah, you build a command post in their basement.
In their basement.
Yeah, yeah.
In their basement. And we sort of invade them, you know, invade their lives and their spaces. And we have to adapt to that.
Sure.
And so you become part of their family and have conversations, you know, with them and you're included. And
grandkids are playing around the house.
Grandkids playing in the house. We had some colorful code names for the two, Lucifer and Satan, who as little kids, you know, they're playing in their grandfather's house and they know where all the cameras are. So they would cover them with mud and put sticks in front of them and leaves so that we couldn't see stuff. And then we'd have to go out there.
So as we've said, the secretary's detail can be a rite of passage, and you later served on the detail again, later in your career.
So the only two really involvement directly with the secretaries was Secretary Schultz, obviously, and then Secretary Albright. When she first started in 1997, we took over the detail duties for Secretary Christopher.
She was, of course, deeply engaged in international affairs, and you traveled with her through some complex negotiations, right?
Yes. You know, the West Bank, Gaza, opening of Gaza, Arafat, key moments in history, Africa. I think we were in the Congo in Freetown with her.
So it was a particularly close connection with her family, I believe. Is that right?
Yes. So we were close with the daughters, similar ages of some of us on the detail, similar interests. They were up and coming professional, very strong women. Incredibly intelligent.
Better nicknames than Satan.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they're successful right now. Mm-hmm. And through the years, some of us stayed in touch with them, even as she left government and went on to do other things. I saw her after she left office. We exchanged Christmas cards. She congratulated me and would send me a personal note when I got promoted to the Senior Foreign Service, for example. I introduced my mother to her when she wrote her second or third book dedicated to my mom. So
wow.
Those are good memories.
And then you and some other alumni from the detail had a role at her passing as well. Is that right?
Yeah, that was really difficult for us, I think, as an organization. One, because she was so instrumental in really defining who we are as a law enforcement agent, getting us LEAP and professionalizing us in a lot of ways, I think ahead of her time. And again, staying very close to the family, I think rightly so, by the family recognizing our role with her particularly and them, they insisted that we become a direct part during her funeral services and then her interment as well. There's iconic images taken of her funeral, again through COVID, but we adapted to that and 8 of us, either current or former DS agents, you know, carried her from the church to her final resting place.
What was that like for you?
Oh, it was powerful. Really, really powerful. Very emotional time for us, especially those of us who spent so much time with her. It was inspiring in that we were able to safely carry her one last time on a trip, right?
There are some especially high-risk countries, as of late had been Afghanistan, Iraq, places like that, where there's another rite of passage for a lot of DS agents who end up serving 1, 2, or 3 or more tours in places like that. You served twice in Kabul, that's correct?
Yes.
So there again, we see an arc. So the first time you were in Kabul was in 2003?
2003, yeah.
What did that look like for you?
It was totally different than my second time, let's put it that way.
Yeah.
You closed the place, so you know exactly what I'm talking about. 2003 was relatively permissive, is how I describe it. It was a complete work zone at that point. No guard force. We relied on an infantry company of Marines to provide the perimeter security and movement to some degree, because our contract footprint was very small. We only had 8 contractors, 4 DS agents.
Wow.
We started. Yeah, I know. Compared to
that's like a small to medium-sized embassy nowadays.
You know, we would get occasional rocket attacks and RPGs mm-hmm. and mortars, but nothing the way it was when you were there, certainly nothing when I was there the second time, to the point where we would be able to drive through the city relatively permissively in unarmored cars, windows down, listening to Johnny Cash smoking cigarettes. And
that's,
you know,
impossible to imagine.
Impossible.
Yeah.
We would go on weekly trips to Bagram, Bagram Air Base, you know, about an hour away. And on one or two occasions, got out to, you know, Panjshir and all the way out to the Torkham Gate of Pakistan. So we would never do that.
I mean, people still talk about those times and how beautiful so much of the countryside is in Afghanistan.
Yeah. On my second R&R, I think, I took a fishing rod because I like to fish. Uh-huh. And I took a fishing rod, folded it up, put it in my luggage, and telescopic one. We were going up to Badakhshan, I think, and it was just beautiful up there, pristine lakes and rivers. And I actually went fishing in Afghanistan. Who does that? it was really, really good.
Wow. So returning to your second full-time tour in Kabul, that was over a decade after your first time. So you got back there in 2016?
2016 to 17, yeah, much, much different, Chad.
Yeah, so how big was
the
shop?
More like you remember it.
How big was the shop in 2016?
2016, I had my own militia. I owned mine, as I call it, probably total of about 2,600 security, including, you know, Gurkhas and movement. We had local guards, of course, you know, Afghans, a large majority of them Afghans.
How many agents did you have by then?
I think I had a TO of 55 or something. So never had them all filled,
of
obviously,
course.
But
in a little over a decade, it went from 4 agents and 100 Marines to 3,600 various gunslingers.
Gunslingers, somebody carrying a weapon. And not only was I charged with making sure the embassy was safe, I looked at it a little bit differently. I looked at it as the keeping the embassy safe meant that we could keep the international zone safe. And by keeping the international zone safer, we would keep the city of Kabul safer. And so we were projecting our mission set outward in collaboration with the Afghan security forces, with U.S. forces, Afghanistan, and with ISAF.
Also in that same 10 years, from being a kind of traditional embassy building to really like a fortress or a sort of series of small fortresses, tell us about what happened on that sort of infamous day at the German Y.
Yeah, it was May of 2017, and I was in the second floor, secure comp from the ambassador, going through our normal 7 o'clock threat brief. And so we were having a discussion in the morning about the threats and his movement, I think. I felt and heard a blast.
Wow.
Huge.
Yeah.
Huge blast. Felt it more than anything else, and this is about a mile away.
This building has been super hardened.
Yeah.
And so sound dampened and electric dampened, and, you know, against all kinds of countermeasures. That's wild.
Oh, yeah. And we felt it, and I looked over at the ambassador, and I said, sir, that was a bomb. I go, that was a big bomb. Everyone went into react mode, if you will, and just began, you know, looking at the carnage and the devastation of what that 13,000-pound truck bomb did.
Wow.
It destroyed Eggers. It leveled the German embassy, and then a surrounding neighborhood looked like Dresden. It was awful.
Wow.
About a 30-foot crater with a truck detonated. We lost 10 guards instantly that day at the Y. I want to say something like 50 of our U.S. personnel wounded, or even more. How we processed all that and really coordinated a lot of the air medical evacuations, we were still left with a devastating gap in our perimeter.
A physical gap, yeah.
A huge, you know, 25-foot gap. And so, you know, we poured resources and men and women into that, and we had to hold the line. Our movement task order and then our static defense task force, the Gurkhas, really, reinforced that and secured it until we were able to make some repairs to it and seal the gap, which we did. It took some time, but we got it done. In the meantime, we're trying to assess the level of damage to the Germans, because they had sustained catastrophic damage to their embassy.
Yeah.
They had some people killed and wounded as well. And we didn't know whether or not they were going to stay in Afghanistan.
Yeah, which would have been a major win for the Taliban.
Huge. I think it would have been a complete win.
Yeah. So the German embassy, the German mission was completely destroyed. What did that mean for their future in the country? How did that work?
It was a series of lightning phone calls back to Berlin between the ambassador, Washington, D.C., and Berlin. What were the options available so that the Germans didn't go? And I recall an ambassador had the German chargé, I believe, over. They were discussing this. 30 minutes later, ambassador comes out with the chargé, departs with his security team, and he says, Carlos, we're taking the Germans on. He described the meeting as very matter-of-factly. Both diplomats shook hands, and that's how we got the Germans.
Wow.
And they moved on to our compound within 24 hours. We were able to give them space so that they had workspace and living space.
Wow.
We welcomed them with open arms. They assimilated very, very quickly and very easily into normal operations. Mm-hmm. We agreed on basic rules.
Sure.
As adults do.
Yeah.
And there was clear expectation management. And as far as I know, they stayed with us for over a year. But the key is that they didn't leave.
Yeah.
And so the message that the Afghans received was loud and it was clear. We were resilient enough, we were strong enough to stay there and finish this job.
So it's been 6 or 7 years, but these were some of your people that we lost, right? I mean, RSO staff is the biggest staff in most compounds, and this was no exception.
It's like that, and you know, I guess it was my turn to do that. But yeah, you talk with these people, these employees, you know, these fathers and you know, these husbands. About a year and a half later, after I had left Afghanistan, I led the effort to have their names recognized at the entrance of SA-20 on our
DS headquarters here.
Yeah, our Heroes Wall. So they're there. But it was tough. And you know, I think of it like that as losing a family member, if you really care about your men and women, and how their loss and the conditions of their loss really affect an entire organization.
On that day, even with modern technology, there was another family connection to that attack for you, where the time it took for you to notify your family of your status on that day. Talk to me again about how that went down.
I learned my lesson, I guess, from, you know, 30 years before, where I needed to let my family know I was okay. So I did that very quickly because I had other stuff to do. But little did I know that, you know, 6 hours after the attack, I wanted to go check on my men and women. So we're touring, we're, you know, I've got the movement guys are all out there and they're covering the ambassador and they're covering me because I'm wearing a suit. I'm not all kitted up. We make our way to the attack site, a 20-foot, 25-foot crater just outside the perimeter of Eggers. And little do I know that PTIDS has got the feed going and they've got it on the ambassador, which they should.
Absolutely.
And next to the ambassador is me. So halfway across the world in our DS command center is this giant PTIDS feed.
Right.
And the senior watch officer at the time was my wife, which is like, what? So
back here in Washington, on this high-tech camera feed, your wife is watching you crawl up to this bomb crater.
It struck her really, really hard emotionally. So she is the SWO, right?
And senior
watch officer. And she's seeing her, I was just married before I went to Afghanistan, so less than 1 year old marriage on this crater that had taken the lives of over 300 people. And it was a lot for her to deal with. We powered through it. She excused herself, went, composed herself, came back and did the job and did her job.
And she's still with the S today?
She's still with the S. She works in protective intelligence investigations out at the National Joint Terrorism Task Force.
Wow.
And it's one of those moments that is difficult for us to talk about, even for her, to put the context into it. And I, you know, I put myself in her shoes and it's, I couldn't imagine.
Yeah.
But again, this is what we do, right? And we persevere.
Wow. Well, sir, I want to thank you so much for your time today. There's many more stories that we will probably pull out of you in future episodes. But for now, I think we'll end on that note. I really, really appreciate your time.
No, it's my pleasure, Chad. Thanks for that. This is a special bond that those of us that have served in places like that, we're never going to break. We'll always be together. So thanks a lot.
Thanks so much.
My pleasure.